In 2021, the Wiradjuri writer Stan Grant wrote about some of the problems entailed in discussing key Aboriginal characters of colonial history. The noble savage, or the doomed race, or the resistance warrior, he notes, these stereotypes are so often rolled out in descriptions about them. But to reduce us to a simple narrative steals our souls. It's possible that all history writing has an element of soul stealing. I've tried in this work nonetheless to inject as much detail and subtlety into Bennelong's life story as my sources could yield. I have done so not only to reverse common understandings about Bennelong, most of them invented in the early 1800s, but also to revise prevailing assumptions about Aboriginal society being simple or ill-fated through the initial period of colonisation. I've tried to portray Philip with equally novel complexity. Like Bennelong, though to far less cost, he has often been remembered in basic ways. In his case, as founding father, or Enlightenment paragon, or even renegade humanitarian. To expand on his global, rationalist, conservative, and complicated paternal contexts casts him as a more interesting and more telling symbol of early settler history. Narrating these lives back to front has helped me make my chief points. It has allowed the general disturbance I wanted to bring to the standard histories of my subjects. Putting the end first has pushed me to recognise throughout that it was empire, rather than New South Wales, that was at the heart of Philip's life. It has also highlighted how Bennelong always focused on his own world, never seeing himself as the other side of an encounter story. I was first inspired to think about writing this history in reverse by a moment in a novel. Claire Fuller's Swimming Lessons, 2017, includes a character who wonders whether his prospective romance might be better if inverted. He wishes it could start with the rage of divorce and then proceed through decreasing unpleasantries so that the giddy hope of new love would be what remained longest. If I could, I would turn our love on its head. We would get the anger, the guilt, the blame, the disappointment, the irritation, the workaday and the humdrum over and done with first. We would have everything to look forward to. The everything of this passage does the most work. It conjures not just the baleful future that the rather pessimistic character imagines, but also all the other possible ways his love might run. It's of course silly and inappropriate to compare a romance with settler-Indigenous relations. Moreover, we stand at the end of the relationship between Philip and Bennelong, while Fuller's character stands at the start of his relationship. Nevertheless, the fictional moment prompted me to unfurl in my mind the comparable lives of Philip and Bennelong, and through them, those of the British Empire and the Eora. It seemed obvious to begin such an exercise in the present, with its still glaring lack of conciliation between settlers and First Nations. But where to end it was much less clear, as I travelled quickly past 1788, past 1770, and even past each man's birth date. It reminded me of philosopher Michel Foucault's remark that what is found at the historical beginning of things is not the inviolable identity of their origin, it is the dissension of other things. Reversing through time also allowed me to glimpse in fresh ways some of the futures, the everything, that the meeting of Bennelong and Philip could have produced, but did not. This isn't to muse wistfully about an imperial connection with Indigenous people that somehow avoided violence and inequality. It is, though, to contemplate seriously the influence of, say, the smallpox epidemic in reducing Indigenous numbers, or what the effect on British behaviour might have been if the French had competed for New South Wales, or what would have ensued if Philip and Bennelong had not diverted more clashes. It is even to wonder about what needed to occur during Britain's various confrontations with Indigenous peoples around the world to crack open its famed Enlightenment values sufficiently to adjust the definition of reasonable possession. Without doubt, the most significant future that could have happened, but didn't, was a treaty between British and Aboriginal leaders. Philip seemed to assume that such agreement would eventuate within his, or at least Bennelong's, lifetime. We see Philip's assumption in his extensive efforts to cultivate Bennelong as a link to the Eora, in the time and cost of those efforts, and in the various minor humiliations he bore as a governor standing before subordinates. We see it in the itinerary he gave Bennelong in London, the same one undertaken by most Indigenous treaty signatories before him, and in the buying of clothes fit for an audience with the king. Some officials may have already decided that New South Wales was going to break with Britain's legal tradition and forgo a formal contract with its prior inhabitants. But the fact that the governor himself was mindful of precedent reminds us that the lack of treaty was not inevitable.